You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network. We continue on a Tuesday. Let's see. What you're going to hear now are interviews that are done, that were done shortly after Vietnam. Shortly after the war, but these guys are all still young guys, physically young guys, you can tell. And then after you hear that, then you're going to hear some of them will be the same guys. In particular, there's a black soldier, I'll get his name, but you see him and you'll hear him, and I'll get his name for you, and then you'll hear him in the second audio. And now he's been on lots of medication. And you'll hear these stories that they tell. For instance, Callie's radio operator, the next morning, they start to move into a minefield there, an area that's mined that Medina has told them not to go into. Callie says, orders guys to go into it, and they refuse. So he goes in with his radio operator. His radio operator steps on a mine and has his foot blown off. And he yells at Callie, "God got me for what happened yesterday. He'll get you." You have these incredible things happening as they start to try to come to grips with what they did. And it changes over the course of time. In that their initial statements, are relatively, I don't want to say cavalier, because they're not, but they somehow or other believe that they did the right thing, which is absolutely stunning. So, in their own words now, these interviews were done in 1970. My Lai happens on March 16th of 1968. My Lai, the village is if you're interested, is right along the coast, and just south of Chu Lai, Marines are familiar with that, and Chu Lai is Da Nang, which was the major naval base and air facility at Da Nang. Which, if you were guarding Da Nang and working around there, then you were fighting the Viet Cong, and then you had in the Central Highlands where you have guys like Carl Marlanis fighting, Operation Dewey Canyon going on up there, things like that. So My Lai is south of Chu Lai along the coast by about, give me one second, as the crow flies, about 65 miles. And little fishing hamlet, just a little bit inland. So that is My Lai. So these interviews done in 1970. And I'll hop in here and either there's some points that I can relate to help out with clarity and points of emphasis. So if you don't mind.
We spoke to five of the American soldiers who were at My Lai on March 16, 1968. They were James Berchtold of Niagara Falls, New York, Gary Garfolo of Stockton, California, Gary Crosley of Del Rio, Texas, Bernardo Simpson of Jackson, Mississippi, and Michael Bernhardt of Tarpon Springs, Florida.
Do you think the training contributed to what happened?
Well, this is something a soldier has to do is to take orders and carry them out.
Like, we used to have to run around yelling, kill, 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 just to get in our heads, you know, just to get that feeling that you can do it. But actually, when it come down to it, and you shoot somebody for the first time, you think about it, you think, you know, you took another human life. But then you think that it's war, you know, and that's the only thing that you could do, and it's either you or them.
One of the things is that when you're just being trained, when you've been inducted, okay, now you're being trained. There's
just every one of these guys were at My Lai, all right? So they're all part of Charlie Company.
Some pointless things that you do. I mean, really pointless. So, I mean, what it does is more or less conditions a man to think that just because it's pointless doesn't necessarily have to be ignored. In other words, you still have to do it, even if they say and it doesn't make any sense.
Was there any harassment of civilians?
I don't know. Like, a lot of the guys would sometimes beat up people and stuff, and stuff like this. Sure, I don't know why.
They would get killed by accident, and there were some rapes at times.
Like the way they handled the village or something like that, or somebody's running, there's a woman running, so they shoot her down. I couldn't imagine why she's running. Why should she run? After all, we only raped three women in the last village, and we killed an old man over there, too.
Like, when we're out there, we're staying out on the ground anywhere, and, you know, we go in a place and see a gook have a transistor radio, you know, and, you know, maybe he might want to have one, so he just took it.
It was just something like the first protest, I guess, you know, the first time that anybody, you know, tried to say anything or do anything, you know, like, you know, don't burn my beard or something like that. I said something about the old man that had something stolen from his house, and he was, you know, just trying to get it back, right? He was just following the troops around, following them, and he didn't go away. So they finally didn't want to be bothered with him anymore. And so they shot him.
What caused the harassment?
I don't think that it's, the main reason was because of the booby traps in the mines.
He was New York. He was from New York by the name of Rocker. And he was walking, I was walking point, I was walking in front of him. And I think I was about 10 or 15 feet in front of him. And I stepped in the same area he did. And as I approached the bush, I heard something go up and it knocked me down. So after the dust and all the brush cleared away, there wasn't anything left of him. He was totally gone.
We were feeling pretty down about all these people that were getting, you know, hit by these, you know, mines and stuff, losing their life. And there's nothing we can do about it, just sneaky stuff, you know. And a lot of us kind of want a little bit of revenge. We'd like to see them, you know, because they're always hiding. We just want to be able to see them and get into it with them, you know, like that.
We had got led into the field by this officer. He was supposed to be knowing where he was going, supposed to be reading the map, and he couldn't.
I don't know whose fault that was. Somebody, you know, something happened. We could have stayed out in the rice paddy, but we didn't. We ended up all up in the high ground in the bushes and everything. That's where the minefield was at. About 20 minutes after it happened, everything was over. They found a sign that was put there at the minefield. It had been laid about 2 weeks before.
Mines are tremendous. You know, I mean, if I were to ever start a revolution or have a war or anything like that in mines, not only, you know, you'd think that the physical effect is devastating, but the psychological effect is so much more so.
Intelligence reported that it was the people within this village that had been setting them. And the area had to be cleaned out. Whether it was done in the right way or not, I'm not to say.
On the night before the attack, your company commander gave a talk to the men.
Yes.
What did he say?
Well, he ran down the operation to us. He told us that we were getting there's going to be a mission, and that we were going to be lifted in by helicopters. There was going to be security, and that we were going to go in there into the Pinkville, and we had a chance to get back for some of the guys that we'd lost in that area, that there were supposed to be Viet Cong in there. At that time, the intelligence report said that they are in there, and they were going to be there, and that when we landed, that when the time of the operation, that there wasn't going to be any villagers in the area that were innocent, you know, that they were going to go to the market or go out in the fields. You know, the people that should be working, that work every day, are going to be out in the fields, the people who go to the market are going to be in the market, and if there's any VC in there, they're going to be there then. And that's, you know, we're going to really get some contact. It's going to be our first really, you know, good exercise, you know, and, you know, everybody was kind of keyed up and afraid and, you know, everything. And
you know, just a couple of points here for emphasis. You can hear him saying it was going to be their first contact. So for whatever reason, I just thought that these guys have been chewed up and chewed up and chewed up. They had been nickel and dimed, booby-trapped and sniped, and were frustrated by it, no doubt. I mean, the Viet Cong would, you know, what are they, stupid? They're going to lay down in front of you in a formation and take you on? Come on, that's crazy. And so they were frustrated, certainly. But they hadn't been there forever, all right? And so they're a relatively new unit to Vietnam. The other piece was, the intel piece, was completely wrong in terms of the Viet Cong regiment that owned that part of South Vietnam. They were not close to My Lai that day and hadn't been there in a while. The reports of there should be no women and children might be legit. It was Saturday, and I guess you'll hear different guys say that you know, that Saturday lots of families go to the markets on Saturday and to buy food and things like that. And then some of the elderly men fish, again, for sustainment, and so they would be out at sea. So that might not be too far off, right? The conundrum is you fly in, you sit down, and all you encounter are women. Women, children, and old men.
He told us to get all our gear in working condition and be ready, you know, to be ready to do battle.
Without any doubt, there wasn't anything else that the men could have picked up from it. Everybody had the same idea. They got the same impression from it. You know, this is going to be a free-for-all. You can shoot anything you want, anything that moves, as long as he's not one of your own.
Said shoot everything, man, woman, children, and the whole bit, everything that could aid the VC, you know, every living thing. That was sort of like the order from the way I heard it. I guess some of the guys could have took it that way, and they wanted, you know, make up for anything that happened. They could do it then, and they might have just went off and did it. Some guys might have just flipped. And there's people that are capable of doing that under those conditions.
What in effect he said was the village would be destroyed and all the people in it and so on.
The implication was just to get rid of everybody.
And we had the night to think about it, you know, and that next morning we moved out.
Well, there was no certain ease not to kill. There was everyone to kill. So that's what we did.
When we took off, it was about 7:30 in the morning.
What's interesting is when you see them talking, you can see them struggling. You can see them swallow hard. You can see them fidgeting. And again, this is 1970, so they're still, you know, trying to cling to this. We did what we were told. We did what we were supposed to do. Very interesting. It's much different years down the road.
We landed about 150, 200 meters outside of the village of My Lai Four. And we went in there, and just as soon as we'd hit, somebody started shooting, you know, into the village. The door gunners were shooting, and the cobras and stuff up there were firing away and everything. I really didn't know what much was going on.
Was anybody shooting back?
I don't think so. I really don't. Because you know when somebody's shooting at you. Because there's a crack pop to the deal, you know.
We got in the village and phoned Captain Medina and asked him what to do.
And he said what?
He said that they were enemies, that this was a search and destroy mission, and carry out our mission.
And your mission was?
Search and destroy.
Search and destroy. And
people started getting killed and everything. And the guys just walking up there and shooting in houses and stuff. Just killing them.
How it started, I don't know. This was something that we were told to do, and we did it.
Did you do any shooting?
A little bit, but not much.
We made a sweep through the village, and there were older men and women. The children were gone, it seemed like. There were very few children there. And
you've seen the pictures, you know that's bullshit. This guy's an interesting guy. He's very he's well dressed in a sport coat and a tie. The other everyone you'll hear, there's two other guys that you'll hear that are dressed in, you know, what I would call 70s clothes. There's a black soldier from Mississippi who's also got a tie on. This guy's an interesting guy when you watch him. He's very much tries to stick to the party line of this whole thing. He's very and the audio sucks though because they're doing it in a car or something that's moving.
We swept through. That's all there was to it.
What happened during the sweep?
What do you mean what happened?
People got killed.
Yes.
Without shooting in return.
Without any return fire.
Without return
this
fire.
This is the type of thing that during training you're told to do. When you have a search and destroy, this is what your orders are to do. You don't question it, unless maybe you are an officer.
Would you repeat that? And would you
search and destroy is a permission whereby you're given an area and you're to destroy anything in that area. After we swept through the village, we turned around, went back through it, and burned all the buildings.
Now, to destroy everything in the village means to destroy the people?
Right.
And this is Milai. Or Milai or something like that. And we, this afternoon, a week after, we had this orders. Our captain, Medina, was telling us about we was going in and burn down and kill everything that was in the village. And that we would leave nothing standing. That's women, children, babies, cows, cats, anything. And that morning, about 7 o'clock, we boarded the choppers and we went into the village. And when we got off the chopper, we started shooting. And I remember from the first incident, as I was coming up on an area, there was a man got up with a weapon and ran into a hamlet. And this lady got up and she ran and turned and had her back turned to me. And my platoon leader, Lieutenant Cross, told me to shoot her. And I said, no, well, you shoot her, man. I don't want to shoot no lady, you know. So he said, well, I'm getting a direct order to shoot. And if you don't shoot her, then you can be shot yourself. So as she was putting her foot in the door, I shot her about 5 or 6 times. And I went there and turned over, and there was a little 3-month-old baby in the arms.
The audio is stunning. It takes your breath away to hear him talk like this.
Which I thought it was a gun, you know. It just kind of cracked me up.
Was the baby dead?
Yes, it was dead.
The bullets had gone through her?
Yes.
Then what happened after that?
Well, after that, we had killed about 5 prisoners. And they told us to guard us. And then here come one of the guys in my squad. Said, well, let's kill him. So the platoon said, well, I'm turning my back, so I don't see what you're doing. And this guy had an M79, a grenade launcher, and you can't shoot a grenade launcher into a group because you can blow up yourself. So he grabbed my rifle and just went to the heads, everyone, and put it between the eyes and just pulled the trigger.
And from there, it sort of grew.
Yeah, it grew on. And they said, my platoon leader told me, he said, my officer, the lieutenant said, well, go in and kill everyone. If you don't kill him, I'm going to watch you all day, and if you don't kill everyone, that you can be shot yourself. So as I went in, he was always near me anyway. So I think I killed about 18 to 20 people. And,
were any of these people children?
That was 2. Yes.
And the rest of them were all men?
Well, but between ages, young and old.
Young and old. Did you see what else was going on in the hamlet?
Oh, yes. I saw Lieutenant Kelly when he said about this grave that they had, this big, massive ditch. I think it was about 50 people at a time. They would put 2 machine guns on each side and put 2 people with rifles, automatic rifles. And he was standing over them, and he said, shoot them. So he just killed all of them, all 50 of them. And then they would make another pile of them, put them in a ditch, and then get another 50 and shoot them and do them the same way.
Did you see any burning of the hamlets?
Oh, yes, we burned all the hamlets. Everything was burned out, yes. We put people in the hamlets and killed them and burned them.
How did the guys look when they were doing this?
They looked like they were having a lot of good time.
Did you see anyone not?
No, I think everybody was just about everybody was busy.
The Vietnamese are funny people. You can't realize what they're thinking of. They seem to have no understanding of life. They don't care whether they live or die.
I was over there. I think I had another guy with me, and I didn't want to stay walking right in that one area because I couldn't see from the tree line what was in the village if there's anything out there. And I wanted to, I saw that ditch over there and knew that it was probably deep or something. There could be somebody in there waiting, you know, to pick us up when we walked by. So I got over to the side and came into the ditch and started walking inside the ditch, you know, and looking around to see. And I hadn't got too far when I saw one Vietnamese family that was dropped there. They had been shot. You know, they were running. They'd obviously had all their belongings, you know, in chogi sticks and baskets. And there was a man, a woman, and a child. And from the way they were on the ground, it looks like they were shot while they were running. And I couldn't tell exactly what did it, you know, what weapon killed them, because, you know, they were just had holes in them. And stopped and I looked at it for a while and, you know, kind of run it through my mind and decided to keep moving on. And I moved on down the ditch, and the firing kind of, it ceased. You know, there wasn't too much firing. Every once in a while I heard a round, you know, being let off somewhere, but I was just more or less looking out around there thinking, you know, like they told us there was supposed to be some action there, and I just wondering where it was. And the rest of the platoon was sweeping in towards the village in about the same direction. And I walked around a little further, and I saw a few more incidents just like that, you know, families being shot. And I was watching the other people, and we hadn't got into the village yet. We were just still on the outside there. And then about then I come upon the road where the main pile of bodies that I did see was, you know, 11 or 12 men, women, and children, just sort of like in a pile there. And that kind of, a lot of us just looked at that, and we knew that something bad had happened, you know, and we just couldn't figure out why. Why was it this way? Why little kids? And, you know, we just didn't know, you know, nobody knew.
It was completely illogical. I mean, no, why should they shoot them? But, well, they were there, that's all. They were there, and whatever was there was supposed to be bad guys.
And you came upon other things?
Yeah. They were.
It's real interesting, you know, he makes that comment, whatever was there, and then he swallows really hard, right? And he tries to smile, but he can't. And he looks down, and you can see these guys fighting it.
There were a lot of bodies laying around, so a lot of people were dead, you know. Stacks, you know, heaps, apparently herded together. There were people on the paths leading away from the village or through the village. And, you know, their bundles were placed on the ground, you know, and then they were dead, which meant that they must have stopped, put the bundle down, and then were killed. You know, the bundle wasn't all over the place, you know, like if they had been running. We didn't see any, as far as resistance is concerned, we didn't encounter any resistance whatsoever.
The Vietnamese have a habit of when you come into a village, they get scared and they huddle. They all get together, you know, and they just, you know, huddle, get in little herds, and it just looked like that's what happened right on that trail, that they were confronted or something. They were either going to or from, because this one road went from another little house into the village, you know, and looked like they were halfway in between there moving, and something had stopped them, caused them to huddle, and they huddled, and they were cut down.
They were infants, in fact. It makes you think that even if they were considered beasts, that you would think that maybe a water buffalo calf or a little piglet would fare better than a child.
Well, they figure that the babies, when they grow up, they will be beasts anyway. So why give them an opportunity to grow up?
It wasn't so much the number, you know, that got me. It was the fact, you know, I mean, if it was just one infant in the whole pile up, it would have been bad enough.
There again, what's going to happen to them is, if they were just left there, they would have died anyway.
Dude, I think there was two kids I should get killed.
Did you wonder why? What did you think when you saw this?
It really never, you know, fazed me that much. I don't know why it didn't, but, you know, it just didn't faze me.
In addition to people being killed, I've been told that there were rapes. You know about any?
Yes.
Why?
I don't know.
They told us about, they are very religious and respect their religious thoughts, you know. They said, like if you kill someone or something, or if you mutilate their body, they think they won't go to, well, heaven or whatever they believe in, you know. and they are very religious about that. They can't stand to see anyone's body, some parts of their body being removed.
A few people talked about it, and we heard some of the guys had, you know, got pretty loose and started doing some stuff, you know, like I heard one guy went wild, you know, with a knife in there and started cutting up people, and, you know, some people had shot people, and I don't know, I just didn't even want to think about it.
Well, it was mutilate the bodies and everything, you know. It was hang them or something like this, or scalp them, anything. They enjoyed, they really enjoyed it, cut their throats.
They cut off ears off of guys and stuff like this there. Not knowing if they're VC or not, but as long as they got an ear, they got a VC.
Like scalps, you know, like from like Indians, you know?
Yeah.
Some people were on that Indian trip over there. And
I think that there were some that did, some that might have enjoyed doing it. But this is, professional soldiers sometimes become this way.
You know, like you could hide under orders and take out your little anxieties, you know, and, you know, which some people probably did do, you know, but I wouldn't shoot anybody like that, and I wouldn't do anything that I never did do anything over there that I didn't want to do.
I was just sort of left out. I was not looked down upon for not having done anything, but just sort of left out of the fun.
There were men that didn't shoot anybody.
How did the guys feel about this?
Well, kind of felt like they were putting the responsibility upon the other soldiers. The job that should have been done was pushed upon the rest of them.
Well, that night, well, we said, everyone was talking about how many they killed and all this, you know, how they killed them and everything.
We heard about just shooting gooks, and like a head count, like, I killed 3 or 4 people, you know, gooks, you know, like.
But that was the kind of talk that was going on, and, you know, chalk that one up for me and all that other stuff.
Well, we didn't think anything of it. Well, we thought a lot of it, of course. I'm exaggerating there. We didn't believe that this would be such a publicity stunt. We felt that this has been happening many times before, and it's probably been happening many times since.
I've heard.
He called it a publicity stunt. We didn't think this would be such a publicity stunt. Pretty amazing.
Stories and talk to different people from different other units, and like that happens, you know, people in villages get shot up a lot, but it just never seems to come down, you know.
How did the officers who were with you react to this?
They did a little bit less talking because, you know, they had to be more. They were a little bit more prudent, I think, because they realized the seriousness of the situation. Not that they had done anything wrong in the eyes of their superior, but that in the eyes of the superior's superior, they had.
Which I thought of.
The, all right, so that's 1970, okay? The only other piece of audio I'll play today, and it's about 22 minutes long, is the audio of the helicopter pilot that day. And I want to introduce him. And then tomorrow what you'll hear is you'll hear these guys years later when they're asked to they're asked to talk about it. This is a little piece the BBC did. His name is Hugh Thompson. He was a helicopter pilot.
When it comes to seeking justice for some of the wrongs committed by American forces, the record hasn't always been that.
Oddly enough, this is being shot in D.C., and it's being shot at the park that houses the National Iwo Jima Monument. So it's in the background.
That good. My guest today flew into the middle of the My Lai massacre in Vietnam in 1968, and stopped the wholesale slaughter of the Vietnamese civilians. It was more than 30 years before anybody even bothered to say thank you. Has the U.S. military now learned the lessons it should have done from Vietnam? Hugh Thompson, a very warm welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
When you hear allegations of brutality by U.S. troops in Iraq, failure to respect the Geneva Conventions, what goes through your mind?
Bad leadership. The past in my situation goes through it. And wondering, has nothing been learned? And how something like this could happen at the prison that seems to have happened. I don't know to what degree because I don't have the facts, but it's, shouldn't have happened.
In 1991, commanders were told when they went for Desert Storm, no Melies.
That's what I heard General Schwarzkopf was his marching orders to his officers. And that made me feel good, because I think we've learned something and are going to go forward. And then to get slapped in the face with this is just horrendous.
Do you think there'll be a full investigation? You've been part of investigations in the past.
I think there's going to be a full investigation.
No, that's not the piece of audio I want you to hear. What I want you to hear is his actual narrative of what he did that day. And I know here's I hope this is the right piece.
During the mission, as it was going on, we kept just reconning around. Started seeing a lot of bodies.
All right, this is Hugh Thompson talking in I believe 1974. And again, he was drugged through the street over what he did. He's a helicopter pilot.
It didn't add up, you know, how all these people were getting killed and wounded. And we weren't receiving any fire. Just, you know, it didn't make sense. There was too many casualties there. And how they were, the locations they were in, you know, figured out artillery couldn't do this. Because there were, you know, bodies in places the artillery didn't hit, trying to get out of the village.
The radio traffic recorded between command helicopters betrays no knowledge of the slaughter that Warrant Officer Thompson was witnessing as he hovered just above ground. Between 9:30 and 10 o'clock, when he saw GIs advancing on another group of defenseless women and children, Thompson ordered his crew to turn their guns on their fellow Americans. Larry Coben was Thompson's door gunner.
Warrant Officer Thompson was desperate to get these civilians, what he believed to be civilians, out of this bunker and into a safe area. He'd seen beforehand that what he was trying to do to help the people on the ground wasn't getting done. He was convinced that the ground forces would kill these people if he couldn't get to them first. He landed the aircraft in between the American forces and the Vietnamese people in the bunker. Got out of the aircraft, had us get out of the aircraft with our weapons to cover him, and he went and had words with a lieutenant on the ground. He asked the lieutenant how he could get these people out of the bunker. The lieutenant said the only way he knew was with hand grenades. So when Warrant Officer Thompson came back to the aircraft, he was furious, and he was desperate to get these people out of the bunker. He told us he was going over to the bunker himself to see if he could get them out. I don't even think he took a rifle with him. I think he was, besides a sidearm, he was relatively unarmed. He told us if the Americans were to open fire on these Vietnamese as he was getting them out of the bunker, that we should return fire on the Americans.
When I did instruct my crew chief and gunner, you know, to open up on them if they open up on any more civilians, I don't know how it felt if they would have opened up on them. But that particular day, I wouldn't have given it a second thought. They were the enemy at that time, I guess. They were damn sure the enemy to the people on the ground.
With the aid of larger helicopter gunships.
Can you imagine that? He lands his helicopter on the ground and goes over and talks to the lieutenant and gets told, yeah, get him out of there with hand grenades. And then, you know, the door gunner's 18 years old. He says, if those guys shoot at me, kill him. It's, you know, just the craziest shit you ever heard, right? In the midst of all of that, this guy, Hugh Thompson, who passed away in 2006, he does the right thing. Unafraid. And one of the things he talked about is he was pissed. He was livid when he got out of that helicopter.
It's Hugh Thompson and his crew succeeded in airlifting to safety over a dozen old men, women, and children.
And this is a Vietnamese woman, but it's interesting, and I'll translate. The first time the Americans came, the children followed them. They gave them sweets to eat. Then they smiled and left. We don't know their language. They smiled and said okay. So we learned the word okay. The second time they came, we poured them water to drink. They didn't say anything. The third time they killed everyone. Killed everybody. Destroyed everything. Nothing was left.
This monument marks the ditch where the largest numbers of people were executed. Scores of people, rounded up in sweeps of the village, were herded here to be shot by Lieutenant Kelly and others acting on his orders.
The people were chased into the ditch like ducks. They fell dead. They were crying, "Oh God, have pity, please help me." "We're innocent, have pity." They shot all the people dead. Then silence. Tiny children crawling along the edge of the ditch. It broke your heart. I thought I was going to die. I couldn't breathe. I was injured. So I crawled here back home. Over there was a naked woman who had been raped, and a virgin girl with her vagina slit open. We don't know why they behave like that.
During flying around, we came across a ditch.
This is Thompson again.
It had bodies in it, a lot of them. Women, kids, old men. I remember the thought going through my mind, how did these people get in a ditch? And I finally thought about the Nazis, I guess, and marching everybody down into the ditch and blowing them away. Here we are supposed to be the good guys in the white hats. It upset me. As we were flying over it one time, we noticed, you know, some movement in it. And Andrada, who was my crew chief, spotted a child moving around.
Andrada's killed not too long after this.
Amongst, you know, the bodies that were in there. So we landed the aircraft next to the ditch. And we got out of it, and my gunner, you know, stood on one side of the aircraft, and I stood on the other. Andrada went down wading, you know, through the bodies and brought back up, you know, a little child about 3 years old. It was obvious how the people got in the ditch by then, I guess. So we got the child on board, and we were, you know, getting that child out of there. There was more we probably could have saved, but we couldn't carry. So we flew the child to Quang Ngai Hospital, I believe it was, and dropped it off with a nun there. It was a very sober flight going over there, very quiet, trying to figure it out. I was looking at the kid, which I thought was a boy about 4 years old, 3 years old. I had a son at home, same age. I was thinking that it could be your kid. It was a quiet flight. Later found out in some investigations and hearings that it was actually a girl. And you really couldn't tell. We checked arms and legs, you know. There's no bullet wounds. Still hurts to think about us doing things like that.
It's absolutely amazing to listen to this audio, and these guys never get away from that. How could they, right? How could they? Now, the next voice you're going to hear is is a younger woman. She must have been in this thing. She's probably in her 20s, so she must have been a mere child when this happened. And there's a sign that says, "Here the Americans killed Mrs. Liu's family, 11 people." I look out of my house and I saw my sister Mui. She was 14 that year. An American was pressing on top of her. She had no clothing on. At the time, I didn't understand what that meant. My sister was trying to resist him. Afterwards, the American got up. He put his clothes on, and then he shot her. Never, oh Americans, Americans. I decided to leave my hiding place. I saw my house had burned completely. And in the yard, my loved ones were burned to death. My mother and my little brother. Still in my mother's arms. My 7-year-old brother whose body was half burned. I didn't know anything anymore. I stood by my mother's body and cried.
As a professional soldier, I had been taught to carry out the orders, and at no time it ever crossed my mind to
This is a sergeant by the name of Hodges. You'll hear him again later. But he was a sergeant. He was a squad leader, Charlie Company.
Disobey or to refuse to carry out an order that was issued by my superiors.
So if one of your men had refused to shoot, what would have happened to him? What would you have said to him?
If one of my men had refused to shoot, I shudder to think what had been the repercussions, because it's hard to say now what I would have done looking back. At the time that it actually, if it had, when it happened, he would have been in serious trouble.
What kind of trouble?
He could have faced a court-martial. He could have been shot on the spot for refusing an order in face of the enemy, in face of hostile fire. Someone refuses to carry out an order, he's in trouble.
But there was no hostile fire.
At the time, we didn't realize that there was no hostile fire at the time.
So are you suggesting that if one of your troops had refused to shoot, shall we say, an old woman or a young child at My Lai on that day, that they would have faced disciplinary action?
They most definitely would have faced disciplinary action had they refused to fire or kill or carry out the orders, yes.
But these were young kids. Most of them had never killed anybody before. I mean, to kill a child seems a monstrous thing. Why were these people able to do this without questioning it?
I feel that they were able to carry out the assigned task, the orders, that meant killing small kids, killing women, because they were soldiers. They were trained that way. They was trained that when you get into combat, it's either you or the enemy. And they were, the people that were in that village, the women, the little kids, the old men, were all considered the enemy.
So, leaving aside the question of following orders, do you think that that order was morally right, and that the actions of the troops that followed that order, yourself included, were behaving in a moral fashion?
I feel that we carried out the orders in a moral fashion, and the orders of destroying the village, of killing the people in the village, I feel that we carried out our orders, and I feel that we did not violate any moral standards.
This GI was the only American casualty at My Lai. He'd accidentally shot himself. Despite the total absence of hostile fire, Kelly continued to order his men to shoot. Most obeyed. A few refused.
Lieutenant Kelly ordered certain people to shoot these people, and I was one of them, and I refused. And he told me that he was going to have me a court-martial when we got back to base camp. I told him what was on my mind at the time. Ordering me to shoot down innocent people, that's not an order. That's craziness to me, you know? And so I don't feel like I have to obey that.
Most
and
of the
if
others...
you want to court-martial me, you do that. If you can get away with it. I feel like it was horrible. You know, just a terrible thing to be going on, and American boys doing this, you know? And I feel like I'm a red-blooded American boy, just like any of the rest of the guys that was there, you know. And to see that, I'm talking about black or white, you know, black and white guys doing this, you know. It didn't make any difference, I'm saying. It just seemed like a horrible thing. I'm talking about, we all came from the same place, to me, you know. We all came from the same place, and I know they all had to have the same values that I had somewhere along the line, if it's... They didn't get it in school. They had to get it in religion, church, or some place, you know. If you didn't go to school, you know, you could pick it up from a stranger, you know. It's just simple, you know. But then to go and do something like this, it's immoral to me, you know. That's just the way I feel about it.
Private Michael Bernhardt was another of the GIs who refused to shoot civilians.
I thought that most of the values that people held were pretty solid, that when we defined things as being good and bad, that they were good or bad. Killing a bunch of civilians in this way...
Now, this is one of the guys that was in the previous thing. He's older, so if the first one was 70, this is probably 75. And listen to the difference in his tone.
Babies, women, old men... people who were unarmed, helpless, was wrong. Every American would know that. And yet, this company, sitting out here, isolated in this one place, didn't see it that way. I'm sure they didn't. What people think of you back home don't matter. This group of people that they were with was all that matters. It was the whole world. What they thought was right was right, and what they thought was wrong was wrong. Courage was seen as stupidity. Cowardice was cunning and wariness. And cruelty and brutality was sometimes seen as heroic. That's the way things began and started to change, and that's what it eventually turned into.
Hold on one second.
Killed around 400 people. Newspapers in America hailed a significant victory, with many enemy dead. For over a year, what really happened at My Lai remained hidden from the outside world.
And then a guy who hears about it over a beer in a bar writes a letter. Now, just know this. Hugh Thompson gets back and he tells the battalion commander what happens. He tells the brigade commander what happens. He tells everybody. And the army doesn't do shit. I mean, imagine that. So, to me, and I, you know, as I watched this yesterday and it rolled around my head last night, why the fuck have I never seen this? And you don't need some Marine Corps captain up in front yakking about this. All you got to do is listen to the audio, show the videos of these people. And you listen to it, and you hear the stuff that they're saying. And it blows your mind. And then the other thing that, some interesting things, and then we'll take a break and then the gunner's going to join us, about all this. You see these flashes of Hugh Thompson, that soldier who refused to do it. He said he can court-martial me. I'm not doing this. How does it go so wrong? And so the reason it bothers me that I've never seen this is, you can have a class in the law of land warfare, or you could have this burned into your brain forever. And part of what you'll hear tomorrow is going to be these guys years later. And how this has impacted their lives. How the bad things that have happened in their life, they attribute to God's retribution on them for what they did that day, what they failed to stop that day. And one of the soldiers, black soldier, I think he's from Mississippi, his name's Sampson, if I'm not mistaken, Simpson. What you'll hear him talk about tomorrow is that his two kids in their neighborhood, teenagers, get in a fight. One goes and gets a gun. He goes to shoot the other kid. A bullet hits his three-year-old nephew and kills him. And he says, as I pick up my nephew, I looked at him. And what I saw was one of the little boys that I killed in Vietnam. So you hear him, he says, I shot a woman in the back. And she was carrying a baby. I thought she might have had a weapon. And the guy says, you mean the bullets went through her body? And he said, yeah, and killed the baby. He says, he then says, he talks about, when I picked up my nephew, I looked at him and I knew this is what I had done myself and the way it impacts their lives. So to me, what I was thinking about last night was this whole concept of keep your honor clean. Right. I don't think the Marine Corps I think there's so many powerful ways that you could do it that when then that make the those classes come alive in a vibrant way, show this stuff, and then say, all right, let's talk about it. What's a lawful order? You know, and again, you can skip the lecture. This stuff is powerful, and you would find the same things, the same horizontal themes go through these different events that we have. This is obviously by far the most catastrophic. Absolutely awful, awful stuff. And again, I had never, and again, I will tell you, I was having a conversation with a Vietnam veteran the other night, and yeah, you know, that's how this came up. Do you ever know, do you know anything about My Lai? And I, you know, and I was a kid. I remember there was a song that got played, that got published about Lieutenant Callie and what a hero he was. In fact, after Callie convicted, there's a huge backlash in the country that Callie's been made a scapegoat. And you can hear Hackworth's attitude as a soldier. He's not a scapegoat. He's a murderer. He should have been lined up against a wall and executed for what he did that day. So, again, I just find it incredibly, incredibly powerful stuff and brings it alive in a way that a lecture with some slides doesn't. To include, you know, the whole Maximus quote. What you do in life echoes in eternity. Okay? You will live with this forever. And you can see these guys. In fact, this Simpson, when you hear him tomorrow, you will hear him talk about he's already tried to kill himself three different times. Three different times. And he tells the interviewer, I might not be here the next time you get here, just so you know. So, incredible stuff. All right, we're going to take a quick break. Michael Musselman, the gunner, joins us next here on a Tuesday edition of All Marine Radio, right here on the All Warrior Radio Network. Are you looking for the perfect gift for somebody who's in the military, for a first responder, for a hunter, for an outdoorsman, or somebody that just likes cool military stuff? I've got the perfect gift for you. The Battle Mug. Starts as 10 pounds of aluminum. It's milled, machined, anodized, adorned with Picatinny rails, and then stamped with the serial number, and it's ready for you to make your own. Anything that went on your rifle or pistol can go on your mug. Scope, laser, camera, light. Put a lid on it and you're ready for the field. If you're inside, add a flag and an emblem and you're set. Perfect for any commemorative event. Farewell, promotion, retirement, birthday, anniversary, or get out of the doghouse. The Battle Mug is the perfect unique gift. Check out the entire line of product at BattleMug.com. Enter the promo code Marine for 15% off. Battle Mug is a veteran-owned and operated company. The product is made entirely in the United States. Check it out. BattleMug.com.